Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and it's 2 days before New Year's. It's the night before New Year's Eve. And one reason I'm doing a live show tonight is inspired by the idea that, you know, folks really need to hear somebody live at times that aren't always the easiest or the best. And so I think it's just a nice idea to have a show this Wednesday before the upcoming New Year's Eve, and maybe to tell some inspiring stories, maybe some not so inspiring stories about how to live life, about how we've lived our lives. So I've invited back a recent guest, my friend, psychologist Michael Cornwall. I hear you there, Michael.
Yes, Peter.
Hi. I've invited Michael back to talk about some episodes in life and things in life that might be worth sharing with all of you as the holidays reach a peak and come to an end. Michael is just a wise person. How about that? He's a Jungian, Langianly oriented psychotherapist. He's got a wonderful blog on madness. What is it? Madness? I forget. What is it now? Madness?
Yeah, Mad in America.
Mad in America. Mad in America. Well, I also occasionally blog. I haven't been doing a lot of blogging lately anywhere. And he has a lot of experience over the years with dealing with very distressed people. And he's had a lot of personal experience of his own. Michael, I thought I would do something unusual, which is start out with two stories by myself. Because it occurred to me as we approached this hour that I have two Christmas stories that are vastly different and yet vastly the same. So would you indulge about 5 or 6 minutes, and let me tell these two stories, and you could comment on them if you like, or just take off with something of your own. But they're both very relevant to living life. One happened Christmas time in the early 70s. I had brought a malpractice suit against Leo Alexander, who's now deceased, who's a psychiatrist in well-connected in Boston, whom I thought represented a lot of things that are evil. He was a very noted supporter of shock treatment, wrote a lot about shock treatment. He was a noted supporter of lobotomy. He'd been our military representative at Nuremberg, where I believe he covered up some of the Nuremberg atrocities as a psychiatrist. He had been a German citizen who'd fled here and spoke German, and so he was in a position to do a lot of harm or good at Nuremberg as the military's psychiatrist. He had made a false claim. He wrote the Nuremberg Code, and I actually corresponded with Jackson, who was our chief attorney there, who said that was absolute nonsense. The code was actually put together by the lawyers and judges. And Alexander had been slandering me and libeling me. He'd written in a major magazine describing me but not naming me, in a major science magazine calling me a paranoid for being against lobotomy. And then at a major conference, the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting, when I attended the lobotomy meetings, which, you know, the Psychiatric Association, lobotomists go to their meetings, the social workers, the therapists to their meetings, you know, and the druggers to their meetings, and they don't come and criticize each other. It's live and let live, no matter what they're doing to people. But I went to make a presence at the lobotomy meeting, and Alexander stood up and did some libeling and slandering, which fortunately my tape recorder caught. And so I sued him. And in the middle of the suit, it was Christmas, I got what looked to me like a subpoena. And the subpoena read that it was freezing all of my assets so that I wouldn't be able to spend any money because I was being sued, and this was, I would not be able to spend any large sums of money until the suit was settled. And I nearly had a heart attack, and then I read it further, and I took some deep breaths, and I realized this was just a copy of the subpoena being sent to me that my attorney, without discussing it with me, sent to Leo Alexander. My attorney laughingly said it was a Christmas present for Leo. You know, we're going to bind up your finances. I didn't even know you could try to do something like that. To this day, I don't know if you can. And when I calmed down, I thought to myself, all right, I want to stop Leo Alexander. I want to stop the lobotomists, the shock doctors, but I don't want to torture them. I don't want to do to them what we did to Leo and what I felt because I thought it had been done to me. And I made a major decision. I'm sure I'd been growing toward that before then, and I'm sure I've failed since then. But I made a decision to not make my reform work personal and not to try to gratuitously injure. So that was a very, very important decision. And then another event, which relates to this in a very remarkable way, was only a few years ago, and again, it's Christmas. And I'm in a trial that is that should have been settled for $40,000. A man had been overdosed with tranquilizers during his MRI and gotten in a car accident. It wasn't the kind of trial I'd usually be involved in, but the judge let me testify about dosing even for an MRI. And it should have been settled. The man had a car accident. Nobody was killed. People recovered. But they wouldn't settle because the same lawyer and I, in the same courtroom a year or two earlier, had won a huge suit. Malpractice suit for a suicide caused by Halcyon. A very wonderful man had killed himself jumping off a building due to calcium. And this was an incredible victory. It still may be a one of a kind in some ways. And they were, these lawyers let it get into their heads, I guess, so they weren't going to settle the next suit. So I'm testifying on the stand. It's Christmas time. You got a picture, big Chicago courtroom, huge, the huge bench, the so-called bench that the judge is sitting behind. And the judge is very elderly. He's a kind man. He's hard of hearing. And he's very sweet to the jury. He's always making sure they had enough bathroom breaks and, you know, that it's convenient for them to come at the time and stuff like that. He's a nice man. And the other side, who has a grudge against me, they're just being vicious and nasty, cross-examining me, calling me names. I'm trying to keep my cool. I'm trying to spiritually touch. I'm reminding myself that Ginger loves me. God loves me. I do good work. Not to fret over this, not to overreact, not to get angry. Just to answer the questions, be pleasant. Even the judge is a little bothered by the cross-exam. One of the few times judges ever intervened in my, when I'm in court, and said, now, don't you talk rudely. And we go on and on, and then we're finished for the day. It's the end of the day, not the trial, but the end of the day. And it's a couple of days before Christmas, not long before Christmas. And I'm getting ready to go home. And I go all across the courtroom to where Barry Chaffetz, the attorney, with whom we won the earlier suit, is standing. I say goodbye to him, and three or four of the jurors run up to the judge. They run up to the judge, and they're looking up at the judge, and they're pointing at me, and they're saying, who does he remind you of? And the judge, never seen anything like this, even in a movie. And the judge looks at them, and he can't hear, so he's like, what? What are you talking about? Who reminds you of? And what they're talking about, and says, Clarence, in a wonderful, well, of course, it was an astonishing courtroom moment. And that was the end of that day. And I, if they'd had any sense, they would have settled the case reasonably at that point. But they didn't. And what was a very small time case, I thought was the jury brought back a verdict of over $500,000 or more. So there are these two stories, the one about not wanting to gratuitously harm people, and then this learning slowly and with such difficulty to be calm to fire, and this great moment in which I'm compared to Clarence the Angel. Michael, a pair of stories, don't they?
Those are wonderful stories, and I want to thank you for inviting me to be on this show in the middle of the holidays. And I think this is the time of year when we do this, sometimes stock-taking, looking towards the new year. Of course, the New Year's resolutions that we make and sometimes don't always keep, but I think it's wonderful to look at events in our lives that, you know, we could, you know, looking back, we can identify them as sometimes major or minor turning points where something really shifted for us. And sometimes it can be under adversity, like you say, or it can be kind of out of the blue, some blessing, something comes to us that, you know, can set us on a path of, you know, more meaning and purpose. And I imagine today that if people are listening or when they get to these archives, there are people out there who are struggling. I know you have a wonderful audience of people who turn to you for support and wisdom. And I just wanted to acknowledge that this time of year, I think for all of us, I know in my work as a therapist, a lot of people really struggle this time of year. Sometimes it's a real setup in different ways with all the commercialism and the expectations and times we've had in our families when the holidays were painful, if sometimes joyous. But I think it's a wonderful time of year to kind of look back and see ways where we made changes and looking forward and how to make changes. Thank you, Peter.
I think one of my biggest changes over the years was learning to control anger. And I think that if you start to do that in the new year, folks, if you start to decide that, like one occasion when I got terribly angry at somebody I loved, many years ago again, I asked God, I just said, listen, the AA model, like the person I was mad at was in AA, and I'd gone to meetings with her. So I knew about the AA model, and I asked God, I can't handle, being angry. I want to give it up to you. If there's somebody that you have to get angry at, you do it. Because when I get angry at people, I don't do it well, and I upset myself, and I'm not effective. I really want to let go of being so angry at all that I see, that even the things that are very important, like the reform work. I just don't want to walk around angry about all this. I want to walk around with a loving attitude toward people and trying to make things better. And I think that's been really key for me in all of my relationships, certainly with my wife, Ginger, 33 or 4 years ago when we finally got to live together and get married. When I would get angry at her, she would just cry. She wouldn't get angry back. And I realized, well, what am I doing? What am I doing? Hurting the woman I love the most in the whole world. So that could be a nice New Year's resolution. I'm always working on this stuff myself. But that could be a good New Year's resolution. Would be, instead of getting angry, just feel your feelings. Feel your vulnerability. Feel your sadness. Feel your anxiety. And see if you can find a loving approach, a loving approach to the situation you're in. And if you can't, maybe you shouldn't be in it. Maybe it's an impossible situation. But if you just decide that anger is something to be given up, it's just a signal you're hurt. And then look at that and to try to find a loving solution. You really will open up huge possibilities in your life? I don't know. Don't you think everybody struggles with anger one way or another, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I know I do, and I think we struggle with all our emotions. When I was getting ready to be with you today, I was looking at your wonderful book again on shame, guilt, and anxiety, and how I love it that a lot of your emphasis and what I've come to see as so important over the years is how we both live with our emotions, how we express them, how they can be so positive at times, so wonderful and joyous, and then so painful. And it made me think, you know, as we were thinking about maybe sharing some points in our lives, stories where something shifted for us, like you told about those two instances at Christmas. Maybe I could just share a little something about how something shifted in my emotional life that was really important for me.
Please.
Yeah, and it was stimulated by reading your book again, and how shame and guilt are so pervasive. And, you know, in your book, you talk about some of the even biological evolutionary roots of all emotion, but those emotions, those legacy emotions, as you call them. But I think, again, even this time of year of Christmas, there's so much expectation, you know, in the holidays and Thanksgiving and things being done a certain way, and the sense of, you know, are we living up to other people's needs and expectations? And so I think shame and guilt are two of the most corrosive and damaging emotions, and I'm so grateful for what you write in your book that I've agreed with for quite a while, is that they really serve no good purpose, that they just haunt us, they torture us, and they do, I think, as you say, too, drive us into states of anger and lashing out and hopelessness. But this turns out to be a positive story. But let me say, this was about 30 years ago. I was kind of still in the first few years of being a therapist. And I was seeing someone who had been through a really hellish childhood and, you know, about as extreme adversity as you can imagine. And their sense of self was so under constant attack from the inner voices. They weren't, you know, in a psychotic state, but they were in this torment of self-loathing, guilt, shame. The person, when I was in the room with them, is, again, I was kind of learning my way as being a therapist. I was, you know, trying to be positive and reframing things and kind of trying to introduce some, you know, some praise. But the person was so besieged by this sense of failure and shame and guilt that nothing I could say was really touching them. It would just, anything I would say, Peter, you've probably seen this before, would kind of set off a chain reaction of memories or feelings of failure and unworthiness. And I was really wondering if I was going to be of any help to this person. And this is someone who'd made a couple of really lethal suicide attempts and had survived them, thank goodness. Anyway, the point of this story was the whole DSM nomenclature and you know, analysis of what goes on with people. I'd previously kind of chucked that. I never really saw people through that lens of pathology or medicalization of their suffering. But I was even saying, you know, the whole concept of depression, as it's talked about, really didn't apply, because what was happening before me was this kind of naked torture of this person by the shame and guilt that they were feeling. So it's just like shame and guilt. That was right there. I didn't even need to talk about depression. And I realized that what I could do is just be there in a way that wasn't judgmental, you know, that saw this person's fundamental innocence and goodness, even without saying anything. I think sometimes we can communicate that just in the way we look at someone, without disdain, without disapproval. And so anyway, over time, it really seemed to help this person. They came to every appointment, started to really just be letting in that there was another human being who was not down on them, who wasn't ashamed of them, who wasn't judging them. And the person gradually really got better and really, you know, thrived. But, you know, Peter, from that point on, it was like, for me, I said, you know, I'm not going to do that to myself anymore. This is a turning point I wanted to pass on to point, you know, to folks, that kind of a story of change that sometimes happens in minor and major ways. But this was a major thing that has been with me for the 30 years, and I touch base with it every day, that I am not going to allow any negative attacks on myself. I mean, up till then, I was like most people, you know. Oh, I would say, you know, if I dropped something, oh, that was stupid. Or, you know, even those kind of seemingly minor ways of us putting ourselves down. So I just kind of drew a line in the sand, Peter, and says, no more. And I know you have that in your book, and I just loved reading that, where you just say, you just got to say no to that stuff. You know, and so at that point, I just said, no more. No more negative criticism. Yes, I will be responsible for my action. I will have remorse. I will have sorrow. I will, you know, have those emotions that are healthy in response to mistakes I made, but I'm not gonna do this to myself, and I'm gonna really support everyone I work with and love to not do that for myself. So I just want, that's my story. It feels kind of like a Christmas gift that keeps on giving to me, that I don't have to look at myself in the mirror and be ashamed and feel guilty. I can struggle to be as good a person as I can, but I don't have to do that to myself.
You know, I think one of the blessings of being a therapist is we get on a daily basis to see how good people are torturing themselves with complete irrational inner self-condemnations of one sort or another that almost always are fairly easily traceable back to childhood, but which just persists. We used to call them tapes, you know, when there were tape recorders. These persist like tapes in people's heads. And that would certainly be a wonderful New Year's resolution to make, which would be to just ferret out all these negative, shaming, anxious, guilt-provoking things you say to yourself, and to just say no more, no more. I'm going to replace this with reason, with sound ethics, not guilt, sound ethics, reason, and love. If you come back to wanting to live a life where your main emotion is love and not anything ugly and terrible, and I don't mean by love dependence and jealousy and all those things that go with relationships, and they may not even have anything to do with love. You can feel jealous and resentful and hateful in relationships that aren't loving. Just love makes them more intense. And just to think about literally filling your heart, your life as much as possible with love, letting go of anger, fighting off all these negative things that come into your heart. I think I wonder, Michael, I've just continually found that being a therapist, which I've now been doing, if I count back to college, would be 1954 when I was a volunteer on the back wards of the state mental hospital at Harvard. I mean, that's working with people for a lot of years now. I don't even want to count whether it was 46 and 15, some very large number comes out. But I'm sure you find the same thing. And if we begin to treat our loved ones with some of the same rules we use in therapy, then we're going to just get happier and happier. And that is to respect the person you're dealing with, never take advantage of the person you're dealing with, to always be as kind and understanding toward the person as you can humanly possibly be, to refrain from activities which scare or threaten them in any way, make it a safe space that they're in with you. I mean, basic sound principles of therapy that I talk about in The Heart of Being Helpful, and that many other people have talked about in different ways. I mean, we should do this with each other, do this with our children as much as possible, and certainly with our adult partners and loved ones. It's a time I want to encourage idealistic thinking in the coming year for folks. Principled, mm-hmm. idealistic. Go for broke. Go for a loving life. Do you think that's too
absolutely.
Fine? How long did it take you to come to grips with the importance of having a loving life? Took me a long time.
I think it
in and out.
Yeah, I think that really was almost a necessity for me. I think on one of the other shows I did with you, I talked about my young experience about 50 years ago of going through a psychotic process, and you know what really saved me was getting in touch with that lovingness in the universe from my family, from my grandmother, you know, from a higher power. But you know, there's been a lot written and said about love, and a lot of it's cheesy and, you know, sentimental, but it's it can be, you know, a daily blessing, and it can have ferocity in it too. I recently wrote something just reminded me what you're saying on Mad in America. I think the name of it is for me, self-love requires both defiance and mercy. So I think that's kind of where I'm at, is saying no to, you know, the guilt and shame. I think this, a lot of love has to start with ourselves, don't you, Peter? You know, if we're having that inner gentleness and tenderness with ourselves, and we're also at the same time able to say no to others mistreating us, mistreating ourselves. I mean, I think you're almost 80 now. I'm almost 70. I wake up every morning and I do what you just said. You know, I just want to be as loving with myself and my family and my friends and the people I serve. I think a life centered on that is wonderful. A while back, when I was kind of going through a crisis a few years ago of about kind of the value of life and, you know, bringing children into the world, this, you know, crazy, dangerous world. And something just came to me, Peter. It was like, you know, life is really worth it. I don't mean to sound flippant, but what came to me was this phrase, life, it's to die for, you know. I think we're justified in bringing children and grandchildren into this world, even as scary and terrible and dangerous as it is, because, you know, it really can be to die for.
Life and love.
Yeah.
Life and love are worth risking one's life and dying for. And people who have had good lives and meaningful lives, I think, have understood this for forever. I think we understood this 10, 20, 30,000 years ago when we were living in small families and wandering the earth as nomads. We had to understand it in order to survive in little bands of human beings against all the elements, all the other animals, and all the other people, too, who were dangerous to us. We had to believe each other in loving each other and to believe in life. The more I look at I've been doing a lot of thinking and reading about anthropology and in particular how we evolved. And, you know, for millions of years, literally millions of years, we were tiny bipeds developing into being the human beings that we are. And we always lived during that whole period of time until 10,000 years ago. We lived pretty much in one way, which was in small groups of people, small bands of people. They might just be a family. A family wandering, or likely an extended family of 20 people, maybe a larger group of 30 people, but not a village, not a town, not several hundred people, and that we developed as extended families supporting each other, loving each other, taking care of each other. Lots of evidence that 50,000 years ago, when we were exactly as we are now, as people, exactly the same biologically, genetically, but living, you know, making our own clothes, making our own weapons, making our own tools, making our own houses, hunting, gathering, that we were very loving, very close-knit, took care of each other. There were older people with injuries and wounds, that, and they were shown in their bones that would have killed them, but they were alive. They lived. They'd obviously been taken care of. And we have to get back to that base, that nurturing basis, that being kind and gentle toward ourselves, as you said, kind and gentle toward other people. It doesn't take the fight out of a person to do that. I think the reason why I can still do reform work, still write, at least one of the reasons. I mean, there's many reasons. One is just good fortune and maybe blessings of God, and one may be genetics, but... there's many reasons, you know, when you live to my age and you're still active, that have nothing to do with you, that are just good fortune. But I think one of the reasons I can be so active at this age and feel like, think of myself as being that old is ridiculous, because it's not how I feel, it's not how I even look. I think a key is that I've continued to do all the things I believe in, but not angrily, rather out of care and concern. In the beginning, very angry young man in the beginning, but I really learned that being loving does not make you defenseless. It doesn't make you give up fighting for justice or truth. In fact, it gives you a whole new perspective on the importance of it, because human beings are vulnerable and they need to be. They need other people and they need themselves to stand up for themselves, take care of themselves. So if you're in a loving mode, it does not rob you of your strength. It also doesn't rob you of your ability to take care of yourself. I love that idea you mentioned about the fierceness in your blog. Talk more about that, because I think that's so true, that to be loving, you have to keep the potential for really being able to protect yourself. Say more about that.
Well, again, I think it's traced back to that decision I made after seeing that extreme suffering, again, of that one person, although there were many others like them, of just the necessity, the absolute necessity to somehow block that self-castigation, that self-harm, really, of the negative judgments and shame. And so I think that takes some defiance, you know, some ferocity, just to say no. You know, what they say, no is a complete sentence. So I think, you know, in the work we do all the time, in our own lives, I think we're challenged to be able to set limits with other people, to, you know, work towards quitting that job that is disrespecting us and hurting us, or moving away from the relationship that is damaging us. It takes, I think, that strength. And a lot of times, it's not just solitary heroism. I think we need a lot of support. I think we need so much support. And I think as we gradually claim that for ourselves, our right to, you know, self-love and to be loving with others, we start to make these networks. Like you say, our modern life is so insular and there's so much isolation that part of the fruits, I think, of claiming our right to happiness and self-love and love for others is risking contact. I know right now some people listening to this are alone, and I've been alone at Christmas. And probably you have too. The holidays. It's hard to be alone. To be lonely, to feel like you're shunned, like you're forgotten, left out. And it takes real courage, I think, to risk reaching out and trying to form relationships, when we've been hurt by relationships. So I think there's both that real tender part of nurturing ourselves and soothing ourselves and being, almost in an innocent state. If we're not guilty, we're innocent. If we're not despicably shameful, then we're beautiful. And I think when we claim that, then we can start to risk reaching out to people and starting to establish those intimate bonds. But you're right. I mean, we didn't evolve this far by everybody living in a cave by themselves, Most people in the neighborhoods they live in don't know their neighbors. The doors are locked, bars are on the windows. We go to work and come home and lock it up. And I think the future is going to be connecting in the ways that you've been inspiring us to do for decades, Peter.
It's so important, folks. I mean, don't be ashamed of the fact that you're lonely. Because being lonely is at the heart of human nature. When we don't have companionship and love, we feel lonely. And that's normal. It's normal to feel lonely if you don't have companionship and love and to feel sad. But we can do something about it if we accept that. Yeah, it is natural to feel so lonely when we don't have the friendships we want, and then to start thinking about, well, how do I build something that really is going to be more meaningful to me in my life? And, I think one of the first things to think about is, what can you give in the new year? What can you give to people that will bring you to be with people? Is it helping at a soup kitchen? Is it volunteering for the Red Cross? Is it getting trained as a fireman or an EMT? Is it going back to school and learning a trade that's useful and valuable to people? Is it volunteering at old age homes? Is it adopting a child or taking care of a foster child? Is it reaching out to someone you love and have been out of touch with? Start thinking about what you can give to other folks and reach in that direction, and it is a certainty that you will eventually, and won't take you all that long, that you will begin to find people whom you can be happy to be with. Maybe not your soulmate, your split apart. That might take a little more time, but certainly, to get human companionship with people you like and value requires that we acknowledge our need. And I think psychotherapy theories would say that, we shouldn't need anybody else to make us happy. Simply don't understand human beings. We need other people. We really, 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 really need other people. That's how we were born. We're made of each other's bodies, for God's sakes. The sperm comes together with the egg and grows out of mom's body. We're made of each other. We're fed by mother's milk, if we're fortunate. And then we're raised from being rather undeveloped little creatures that can't even stand erect or take care of ourselves to human beings by other humans. We need each other. We shouldn't be ashamed of that. Be glad in the new year to know you're like everyone else and you need folks. And just think to yourself, what do I have to get rid of? What do I have to get past to reach out to this very positive goal of really enjoying of other human beings? And I think Michael's emphasis on saying no, absolutely no, to through all these terrible things that discourage us. You're ugly. No one will love you. You're bad. Life sucks. Why bring up somebody in this world? By the way, we in America are so blessed in this world because seldom in the 2 or 3 million history of bipeds has been there a place where we're safe as we are right now, living here in America and in Western Europe and so on. Because believe me, wandering around in a group of 25 or 30 people following animals that are migrating north and migrating south and staving off the heat of the fire and armed with spear, and maybe in more modern times a bow and arrow, believe me, it did feel very safe. We live in such comparative safety now. Don't ever use the world we live in as an excuse for not developing a happy life for yourself. And of course, there is so much misery in the world around us. That should be an invitation for us to do more. Do more for others. Not lament the world. It's an opportunity. An opportunity to do more for others. Oh boy, how you doing?
Well, that makes me think that, you know, these junctures in our life, which can happen every day in minor ways and sometimes in bigger ways, it has so much to do about, you know, finding our own way. And for those 30 years I worked for County Mental Health, I saw every day, you know, how even in America, as like you say, we're not having a war on our territory, bombs aren't falling around us, but there's great pain and suffering in America too, with poverty and racism and a lot of people struggling day by day to put food on the table for their kids. So I think finding, in addition to, you know, that self-love and our ability to love ourselves and others, I think you and I, in a way, have been blessed, Peter, because from a pretty early age, we kind of had a calling. You know, yeah, we started out as angry young men, but, you know, we had a vocation we're probably going to do till the day we drop. But I think for the people I see, finding the meaning of what they want to do, what their soul really wants to do, you know, it could be being living in solitude. It could be a very, very simple life. Of course, things change. Different phases in our life, we have different things called to us. Sometimes people won't understand, you know, what we need to do. I mean, that's another thing about saying yes and saying no. Saying yes to what we want to do with our lives and saying no to other people's expectations. Reminds me of one of the people that I interviewed when I was doing that doctoral research on that program that let people go through their psychosis without meds. And she had been, you know, really programmed by her family to be an attorney from the early age. You know, either you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. Well, she says, well, I guess I'll be a lawyer. And so went to law school and everything and was just past the bar and was about to start that. And then her soul said, No. And she went off, you know, to the real deep end about this. This was like not her. This was not who she was supposed to be. And so she had to go through this turmoil of psychosis and kind of reorienting her life. And then she became an artist. She never practiced law. So, I think for people, too, to find that it can be a very simple thing, you know, what fulfills me is to be to garden, to have a very simple, low-stress job. It doesn't have to be heroic and public. And I'm just trying to say that trying to find that kind of true north, you know, that inner compass that we, you know, when we feel like you said, when you've adjusted your life at times to like, okay, to have everything line up, you really need to do this or that or do more of the reform work or something. Just trying to find that inner compass of, you know, the new year's coming. Maybe people will make some changes this year. I remember Joseph Campbell, the mythologist a lot of people have heard of. He was a kind of a dramatic example of someone who, you know, had this really high-profile professor teaching career at one of the major universities. And he says, I need to stop this right now. And he went and, you know, sat in a cabin for about 5 years and just read, right? Remember that? And so he's the guy who came up with the phrase, follow your bliss, which is kind of a cliche now. But I think that's part of, you know, new beginnings, too.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the emphasis on that almost every walk of life has the opportunity to be creative and caring. My wife works with a number of tradesmen, and she's at times functioning as a kind of a contractor. And I meet a lot of these men and some women who are doing jobs that may be putting up drywall or carpentry or plumbing, heating, all these different things. And you see those individuals who really want to do their job, who actually enjoy their skills, who want to be seen as honest, and who actually relate to the people around them. And she has a number of men around her who do work that is very different from what you and I do, and who clearly get great satisfaction from it, and often do have a loved one in their life that they really value and cherish, and often are taking care of their children and making a good life for themselves. It always requires effort. It always requires taking responsibility for being somebody who is doing their best to give and to do it in an ethical and honest way, and to create love, to create caring, to create relationship. And it can just be done in small what people think of as small arenas, where you actually end up doing much more good than most of the people operating in the so-called large arena. In the new year, if you have any doubts about yourself and about life, really begin to contemplate on who do you love? Is there a specific person? That your husband or wife or your children or somebody you haven't seen in a long time or a parent? Who do you love? And if there's no one that you really, really love, how are you going to start looking for them? What do you really love to do? What do you love to do with your hands, with your mind, with your thoughts? Think about how you can do more of that in the coming year. If you do what you love and believe in, you will have the best possible life. And there is enormous possibility for all of us in this complicated world to give a great deal to other human beings. The more you focus on that, the less you'll even be worried about yourself. We'll be thinking about yourself, and the less you'll accept these mean things you've learned over many, many years to say to yourself. Michael?
Well,
more from you as we get near the end. Go ahead.
Okay. I can't help but think, as you're saying that, for your audience and for the people you and I have known, when I'm done here, I'm going to go see some, for lack of a better word, clients at my office, you know, who are going through distress and are really challenged. And I know of your audience out there, there are probably people listening who the challenge of the day is to do self-care and to heal. And God knows a lot of that healing, as you more than anyone has pointed out, is from the effects of some of the mistreatment of psychiatry. And so I'm just thinking of them right now and how, you know, when we're so much struggling that we can't do much more than, you know, do that self-love and try and nurture ourselves and heal ourselves and take care of our bodies. But I think your message all these years, Peter, has always been of, you know, kind of nakedly looking at the truth of the challenges people are up against and the harm that's done to them by some of the medical practices, but always with the balance of then hope. So I just would encourage people who are struggling, who are survivors of the system, who are in recovery, who are trying to deal with the effects of psych drugs or different kinds of mistreatment, that in a way, you know, that's, without being presumptuous, that's a vocation in itself, isn't it, Peter, to heal, to try and renew ourselves?
Oh, sure, it's certainly a part of what we have to constantly be doing, renewing ourselves and living within generations, within the years we find ourselves. I have to approach life differently at my age than I did when I was younger. But John, there's some other thing I want to say, and we're two good people to talk about that, folks. And that is, life doesn't necessarily get bleaker as you get older. That is just simply untrue. So another good thought I'm going to leave you with is that by and large, and this is only true as far as I know, these are from studies that have been conducted in the Western world, that the older you get, the happier and more carefree your life becomes. So that even though you get older, you lose more people, you face more illness, and there are certain new limits on yourself, most people grow more happy. And they grow more happy because they have more and better perspective, because they've learned better ways to, for example, as I've been discussing, control their anger, and because they've learned to treasure more the love that's in their lives. So your life can be a positive growth curve. It really can be. As low as it might feel today, it can be really higher and better than you imagined later on. Don't just try to survive. Don't be a survivor at all. Really thrive. Really triumph. Really look forward to becoming a source of love, and a more and more responsible person who has something really useful to offer other human beings. It's how we've always lived, and it's why we're successful as a species, because we've cooperated and cared about each other, not because we've competed with each other. We do that too. I was interested, I've been studying more and more of Darwin in the last few years, because I find that of all the people I read, and he is in many ways the closest to my thinking in many ways. And one of the things that Darwin pointed out in Descent of Man is it's not about survival of the fittest. He uses the word, that phrase, three times in his big book, only three times in the big book about human nature and evolution, the Descent of Man. And he says, and one of the three times he mentions it, he says, I think I over-exaggerated it before. It's not what life is about. It's not about survival of the fittest. It's about human life. It's about cooperation, mutuality, and sympathy for one another. And it's about things that rise above evolution, he says, that can't possibly be explained by biological evolution itself. Things that require culture and education and thought and free will. He talks about all this. And he talks about the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, as a creation that cannot simply be explained by our social instincts, but is the highest point of our conscious achievements. Well, that's who we are, folks. Don't let anybody tell you you're just biochemical. Don't let anybody give you a bunch of malarkey that you have a disease or a disorder that's making your life unhappy. It's all about human consciousness and awareness and how we can lift ourselves as individuals and as a group to more sympathy, we would call it empathy, more mutuality, more cooperation, more caring, more building of valuable lives, and for those of us who wish to be reformers, also standing up for the vulnerable among us in one way or another. We've got about 2 minutes left. My guest today is dear old friend Michael Cornwall, and you can reach Michael at his website, which is What is Madness? And he blogs on Mad in America. You will enjoy and learn from his blogs and maybe be inspired to do some reform work or maybe just to enjoy loving more. My thoughts for the last minute or two?
You know, I'm just sitting here smiling. I'm just really grateful for this time with you and you know, your audience out there. And I just love what you said about we really are social beings, but we're loving beings too. And ultimately, that's the meaning of life, I think. If I dare say so, you know, that we just claim that birthright. We have a birthright, and it's not the social Darwinism and all the competitiveness and all that. That's not it. You've been on the money for a long time on this, so thank you again.
Well, listen, folks, it's the new year. Whether you're listening to this at the beginning of 2016 or 17 or 18 or 19, I hope you'll be listening to my stuff for a long time. Michael and I wish all of you a good new year, the best conceivable new year that you can develop in your hopes and wishes and bring to fruition with your loved ones. Don't settle for less than you're capable of as a conscious human being. Michael Cornwall, thanks for being on the show with me. And a good new year to everyone.
Thank you.